Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
There's a lot of clamoring on in this culture about freedom. And I saw it on TV when I picked up my lunch today. We can be pretty self-congratulatory as a nation about our successes in securing our freedoms. But you can't just tweet, fight for freedom, and expect the world to change. Some freedoms are, like Suzuki says, superficial and illusory. I don't think we are free in the way that we can easily tend to think we are sometimes. And to be mistaken on this point can be extremely damaging to ourselves and to others. I think it's always important to be questioning what freedom is and what we are doing to truly and deeply free ourselves. It's been said that Zen is a path to freedom. But a common perspective of Buddhism in the West, and increasingly religion at large, I think, is that it's something that's something of a retreat or a refuge. That if you're really going to be living a full life, then there isn't going to be a utility or place for rigorous religious practice. Maybe if you hypothesize of being on a deserted island, but every arena that matters, we have to get serious and focus. And I think in terms of the hard-headed, realistic view, I get shit done. Back in 2015, I spoke here about David Foster Wallace's commencement speech to Kenyon College. Wallace was a reclusive writer whose belief was that education was the source of inner freedom, that learning to exercise choice in how and what we think grants us as students the power to be lords over our own tiny skull-sized kingdoms. This image of a tiny skull-sized kingdom reminds me of another image used by British philosopher Isaiah Berlin. He talks about an inner citadel, which you can probably picture if you're a Lord of the Rings fan like me, the fortress within the fortress. Berlin is the man who popularized the theory of value pluralism, an idea that originates with 19th century English liberals. This idea is that we all have different values and that there's really no fair way to order them. They can be equally valid. And also, values amongst peoples may be mutually incompatible and require pragmatic reconciliation. This is a meta-ethical theory that connects to this nuanced view of freedom I'll share tonight. But it also defines ideas that are not always easy to talk about. When you start getting into the actual act of relating values, the conversation can sometimes get uncomfortable. Here's what Berlin writes about this topic in his speech titled, Two Concepts of Liberty. I may be prevented by the laws of nature, or by accidents, or the activities of men, or the effect, often undesigned, of human institutions. These forces may be too much for me. What am I to do to avoid being crushed by them? I must free myself from desires I know I cannot realize. I wish to be master of my kingdom, but my frontiers are long and insecure. Therefore, I contract them in order to reduce or eliminate the vulnerable area. It is as if I had performed a strategic retreat into an inner citadel. My reason, my soul, my noumenal self, which do what they may, neither external blind force nor human malice can touch. I have withdrawn into myself. There and there alone I am secure. It is as if I were to say, I have a wound in my leg. There are two methods of freeing myself from this pain. One is to heal the wound. But if the cure is too difficult or uncertain, there is another method. I can get rid of the wound by cutting off my leg. If I train myself to want nothing, to which the possession of my leg is indispensable, I shall not feel the lack of it. This is the traditional self-freeing of ascetics and quietists, of Stoics or Buddhist sages, men of various religions or none who have fled the world and escaped the yoke of society or public opinion, by some process of deliberate self-transformation that enables them to care no longer for any of its values, to remain isolated and independent, on its edges, no longer vulnerable to any of its weapons. All political isolationism, all economic autarky, every form of autonomy has in it some element of this attitude. I eliminate the obstacles in my path by abandoning the path. I retreat into my own sect. Less is remarked that Canando may be considered more of a sanctuary than a refuge. We have to go out into the world. This is not a residential center. One day about a year ago, he came into Starbucks and said, Buddhism needs a political voice. This, like several things he has said to me since I first met him, gave me a shock. I felt I was just getting kind of comfortable in my day-to-day life. I felt a semblance of what Berlin calls positive freedom, the freedom, as the U.S. Army slogan touts recruits with, to be all that you can be. It can also be called self-mastery. And there's many ways that people can be denied this type of freedom. Poverty, food and water security, sanitation, access to nature, censorship, non-representation, and all the freedoms of adulthood that most of us enjoy. I'm saying I feel I have an abundant life. I'm basically personally content, and I know that I'm very fortunate to be that way. This kind of freedom is only part of what we want, though. Other values we yearn for are connection and equality. We value connection with other people and equality amongst peoples and peoples. And these values compete in a sense. We may hold back some of the freedoms of some group to protect another. My brother-in-law is planning to have egg-laying chickens at his house in Truckee. And he was describing the measures he would have to put in to protect the chickens from the red-tailed hawks that are common there. His policies are pro-chicken. They're anti-hawk. And we do this all the time socially. Protect the weak or vulnerable from the strong or predatory. Negative freedom is what you're able to do, to be or do, without external interference. The physical freedom that Suzuki Roshi referred to is part of negative freedom. Negative freedom is the focus of mainstream culture. What practice does, in my view, is create the conditions for developing character, for realizing potential of being free in the positive sense. 500 years ago, Martin Luther wrote the hymn, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." And Christianity gradually shifted from Berlin's inner citadel to the external walls. Christianity gradually shifted from a more contemplative religion to a more executive one as rational societies began to develop. Most of recorded human history has been characterized by monarchical leadership: kings, queens, emperors, caliphs, sultans, and so on. And so this has socially been tied to Western conceptions of God and thus wired into attitudes and approaches of our human endeavors. If mythology is, as Joseph Campbell and other comparative religion scholars defined it, other people's religion, then the dominant mythology of the last few millennia in the West has, of course, been Christianity. The story of an all-powerful deity that made the world and that we owe our existence and thus our obedience to. And in that mythology, the individual is made to feel like they don't belong because they sin. And God's grace is so great that you're not struck down. And this was the primary mythology of the home I grew up in, especially when disputes arose. 200 or 300 years ago, a precipitous political movement began. The European intellectual elite began to undermine the monarchs and the subjects. And popular uprisings killed or deposed the kings and those loyal to him. And they did so professing that it was for freedom. And certainly freedom for the people was not freedom for the king. There was a value shift, and it was a violent one. And out of this, a new popular mythology developed, and it was called the Enlightenment. It's characterized by a rational view of social systems and enables objective, evidence-based scientific methods. Even though Zen emphasizes freedom, this Zendo still resembles a throne room. If you come in, you see the Buddha with his back to the wall. And if you're a Game of Thrones fan like me, you'll see in the throne room, when the queen or king sits with their back to the wall, that there are lords and henchmen that are arrayed around the monarch to protect them. And these were places of prostrations and other protocols of obeisance. The irrational monarchical conceptions of the cosmos are more difficult to see, and they were slow to change. The social barriers I described prevented a popular return to grassroots, to a grassroots kind of inner orientation, the inner orientation of how we think about the world, our conceptions of the world as individuals. And in particular, what developed then was a humanistic emphasis on the greatness or exceptionality of particular cultures or nations to which people felt they belonged. A lot of people are uncomfortable with contemporary claims of American greatness. You know, these red hats that people wear. Yeah. They're kind of a cultural indicator of something, and I think it needs closer examination. I think we have to remember that these original claims grew directly out of the fervor for democracy, a social innovation from which a tremendous amount of social and material advances emerged. And this is incredible, as you know, but limited. A particular strain of greatness traces back to the late 19th century and most strongly to Theodore Roosevelt. It's called individualism in this country, but it's also a potential source of personal tyranny. We have an idea of greatness that causes us suffering and some loss of freedom. Just over 100 years ago, Roosevelt gave a speech titled Citizenship in the Republic. And he gave that in Paris, one of those state visits right after he was no longer president, like the year after. It's based on ideas that he'd been ruminating on, though, for at least 20 years. If you want to understand both the strengths and deficiencies of America, and politics is the domain of that, this quote may be a good place to start. Within this quote, within this speech, there's a quote so well known that it has its own name, the man in the arena. JFK quoted it. Nixon quoted it when he left office. Cadillac featured it in an ad a few years ago. Do you know that movie Invictus? Morgan Freeman, South African rugby team. Invictus is a poem. Morgan Freeman plays Nelson Mandela, and he gives the South African rugby captain the poem Invictus, except in real life he didn't give him Invictus, he gave him the man in the arena. And it's the quote that I spoke at my high school graduation the year before. It struck a chord with me because I was leaving a few weeks later to go to the Air Force Academy. And I was proud to read it to my class and community. I felt that they were proud of me. And it would be a long time until I felt connected to a community like that again. Here's the quote. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows, in the end, the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. Do any of you listen to TED Talks? One of the very popular, most popular TED Talks is by Brené Brown on vulnerability. And she has a new book called Daring Greatly, which is from this quote. But in her TED Talk, she identifies traits of the wholehearted. She says, wholehearted people had the willingness to say, I love you first. They had the sense of courage, which was to tell the world the story of who they are with their whole heart. They had the compassion to be kind to themselves first and then to others. They could let go of who they should be and be who they are. They had the courage to be imperfect. They had connection as a result of authenticity. The willingness to do something where there were no guarantees, to invest in relationships that might not pan out. And they saw vulnerability as neither comfortable nor excruciating, but as being necessary. And above all, she says, those who live wholeheartedly believe they are worthy of love and belonging. That's the only difference, she says, between people who are not living wholeheartedly, according to her research, in typical TED Talk format. 20 years ago, when I left the Midwest to come here, I told my dad that I wanted to be great. And it was a conversation stopper. And he was angry, and I think now it was for the adult son that he knew he wouldn't see as much as he'd hoped. And we've never been as close since I've been an adult. We have difficulty relating to each other. And I think it's just because we're not physically together. It's a warm relationship, but it's one that requires you to be close. So phone calls and letters can't really substitute. When the Cardinals won the other night and their Hall of Fame catcher, Yadi Molina, hit the game-winning sacrifice fly, you know, I texted him. And, you know, he gave me a stat about how many pitchers he'd serviced and how many balls he had caught that night and said he was a legend. But I didn't know how fully at the time what it would cost me, my desire to be great. And I don't think now that it's possible to know that. It's not to say I wasn't arrogant through the desire, but I think this is a natural motivation. I was persisting with this self-belief and stubborn and idealistic about it. I feel different about that quote now. I've turned a few corners since I was 18. And so I would say now, greatness is great when it doesn't hurt or put down other people or any other beings. You know, Mark Twain was living back then, and he said, great people make you feel like you could be great too. But great today also takes all other people and places up with it. We have one world, and so there are moral questions we sometimes need to answer and sometimes let go of. So I've redefined that quote for myself. As I know it was originally conceived by Roosevelt. America may have a new kind of poverty. Heroes are universal, but maybe our heroes have never been so diverse and personally tailored. Yes, we see our heroes acting courageously and feel our heroes speaking the truth. You could deem Bodhidharma a hero. Many people claim Donald Trump as their hero. And who your heroes are will both inform and reflect your values and your interpretations of the world. Maybe above all, what draws us to heroes is that heroes are free to act. As you know, when they act, they encounter challenges. And somewhere in their struggle with challenges, the power of free choice and moral action. And that's not rational. That's courage. In all cultures, just like the great stories, the heroes change. Gilgamesh has a different thing going on to Obi-Wan Kenobi. They are creations of different value structures. The heroes I've encountered in both life and literature are woven into some of the bedrock of my motivation in life. But my mom and dad were my first heroes. When I was in my 20s, my dad hung a copy of that same quote, the same Roosevelt quote, above his desk at home. And I thought I was being really real, speaking from the heart, when I told him that Teddy Roosevelt was kind of a son of a bitch. To which he paused and replied, well, he did found the national park system. A reasonable response, an orientation towards physical freedom. And now I think rather than a statement of a simple historical fact, his response could have been even more simple. What's on your mind, son? At that time, I strongly associated that quote with the military, where I had seen highly organized and technologically advanced systems of violence. These were thoughts that were extremely painful for me and continued to be for years afterwards. My dad and I failed to connect that day because neither of us were vulnerable enough or sensitive enough to ask the next question, the heartfelt question. The second patriarch of China, Weka or Aka, cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma as a representation of complete commitment. It wasn't a ticket for entry. It wasn't a valued commodity. He wasn't training, as Isaiah Berlin spoke about, to not want. He wasn't responding to a franchise opportunity he saw in the classifieds. And it wasn't a physical freedom like visiting Yosemite. It was a positive act of sincere understanding that our true nature is empty. This is a big gulf we bridge, slowly, day by day, with real practice. Without, with all. Go right ahead into the arena. With with We live in an era of sports heroes, and what were once kids' games have been elevated since the time of Roosevelt into a high form of performance art and big business. Maybe you heard about the tweet a few days ago about the NBA GM who tweeted, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." There was a big reaction, like billions of dollars big reaction. Big sponsorships from Chinese companies are being suspended, and the NBA commissioner held a press conference saying, I think as a values-based organization that I want to make it clear that Daryl Morey, this is the GM, is supported in terms of his ability to exercise his freedom of expression. There are values that have been part of this league from its earliest days, and that includes free expression, he said. Everyone wants to know right now if the GM is going to keep his job, but I think a more natural question is, what are the values of the Chinese? Clearly, the tweet violated some of them. And here's Silver later in the talk. I would like to believe, as a combination of Daryl Morey's tweet and Joe Tsai, he's the Taiwanese owner of the Brooklyn Nets, and Joe Tsai's response, that many sports fans don't pay all that much attention to politics or to the situation in China and Hong Kong, and may as a result know far more now about the situation. So what do you think? Is that value pluralist? I've attempted thus far to speak about this cultural confusion between these domains that charge up basketball fans. NBA is probably the most politically active organization in professional sports for various reasons. In Philadelphia last night, two people were kicked out of a Philadelphia 76ers game for holding up signs that said "Free Hong Kong." Philadelphia, by popular account, the birthplace of freedom in this country and the city of brotherly love. Philadelphia had an undersized basketball player from Hampton, Virginia, who's now in the NBA Hall of Fame. He actually, coincidentally, is China's favorite player, too. He still travels back there every year. Chinese will say Yao Ming is their favorite player, but really they love AI, Allen Iverson. And I love AI. He's a great basketball player, the best I've ever seen. He's small, but physically aggressive and tough on the court. He played hard and with heart. And let's step back for a second. Why do the Chinese love the NBA so much at all? What is it the NBA symbolizes to them? What's making them so anxious? Do you want to hear about my favorite AI moment? Okay.
Yes.
Well, my wife and I had season tickets to the Timberwolves back in 2000. And they had this amazing player, also from Virginia, named Kevin Garnett. And his nickname was the Big Ticket. So you had, AI was the answer. The more you're loved as an NBA player, the more nicknames you have. But so we're watching, and we got these pretty cheap seats, but perfect for this one move that AI makes. He's up on the key, and he crosses over Kevin Garnett. And this guy is huge. Kevin Garnett he's 6'11", but his wingspan's about 7'4", and he's about the fastest, most athletic 7-footer you've ever seen. Allen Iverson's 5'11", 160. And so he crosses him over at the top of the key, and he cuts to the right. And there's a point where he jumps into the air, and he jumps so high and into Garnett that his hip is up at Garnett's like shoulder so that he can't block. But even so, his arms are so long that he could still block it. So then Iverson, he goes under the basket and he dunks it behind, he shields the ball from being blocked by the basket itself, draws the foul and gets the dunk. It's the most athletic feat I've ever seen. And now I work with some brilliant people in my day job that in about 2 months could build a robot, a basketball robot that could beat about any human. But it's still mysterious to me that there's nothing or nobody that will play basketball like Allen Iverson. I can relate to AI, and I think we all can, because he represents so clearly many of the potential pitfalls that deny us freedom. There's footage of a 2002 press conference that took place just after the 76ers were eliminated from the playoffs. Iverson was already under a lot of pressure and had been badmouthed by fans and even his coach. In the previous week, in the middle of the playoff series, his coach Larry Brown told the press that he had issues with Iverson not coming to practice. He described Iverson as a child that he was charged as head coach with helping. He said, "I got a young kid with a big heart, and I got to figure out a way to help him out." And as you'll hear, that's what really bothered Iverson and why their relationship suffered. His coach was being paternalistic. And after a disappointing Game 5 loss, he was required to speak to the reporters. And I keep coming back to this exchange because I think it offers a window into the limits of freedom in our society. You can look at it this way, that Iverson and the reporters exhibit this clash between the two major mythologies that are still active in America today, still prominent, still competing, Christianity and the rational enlightenment. Iverson's a Christian, but he's a Christian with a wonderful sense of humor. That's how he plays and that's how he lives. But there's a tyranny embedded in the attitude of the coach, the press, the way he's being treated as a result of failing to meet the high expectations of the previous season where they made it to the NBA Finals. Immanuel Kant was the first philosopher to describe this tyrannical paternalism and challenge the rational enlightenment. And yet now, more than 200 years later, paternalism can be so ever-present in our daily lives, so tied up in our mythologies, that our basic orientations, we, many of us, are not able to see our way out of it. You know, when I was a freshman in high school, on a Saturday, my dad came up to me and he said, "I don't want you to go out for the freshman basketball team." And that would probably not make much notable news, except he was the coach. And I had been waiting for years to go out for that team. And I was just thinking tonight, as I was sitting here, that if I could go back in time and say one thing in my life, I would say, that all sounds great, Dad. That sounds very reasonable, but I'll see you at practice Monday. And to this day, most of the people I talk to about Iverson will still say, "He should have went to practice." But try to separate the player from the person and really hear his words as he describes his disappointment with his relationships moments after leaving the arena and sitting in a room with his back to the wall, festooned with the team and corporate logos. Comcast, yeah. Are you on the same page as with Brown? Yeah, we on the same page. I don't have no problem with Coach. I love Larry Brown. You people may not believe it or feel me when I say it, but I do. You know, he's done so much for me in my career. Just help me be the player that I am. If there's no Larry Brown, I don't think there's no MVP Allen Iverson. He's done a lot for me, helping me as far as helping me on the court and off the court. But I mean, when you lose, this is the type of shit that happens. This is what goes on. When you win, everything is everything. Everything is cool. But when you lose, it's about Allen Iverson and Larry Brown. When I know when we win, I get the praise, Larry Brown get the praise, but when we lose, it's on me, and it's on Larry Brown. And that's just something I have to accept and, you know, deal with. If I can't practice, I can't practice. If I'm hurt, I'm hurt. Simple as that. It's not about that. It's not about that at all. But it's easy to talk about it. It's easy to sum it up when you just talk about practice. We sitting here, and I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we in here talking about practice. I mean, listen, man, we talking about practice. Not a game. Not a game. Not the game, man. We talking about practice. Not the game. Not the game that I go out there and die for and play every game like it's my last. Not the game. We talking about practice, man. I mean, how silly is that? Practice? We talking about practice, man. I know I'm supposed to be there. I know I'm supposed to lead by example. I know that. And I ain't shoving it aside or saying it don't mean nothing. I know it's important. I honestly do. But we talking about practice, man. What are we talking about? Practice? We talking about practice, man. We talking about practice. We ain't talking about the game. We talking about practice, man. When you come into the arena and you see me play, don't you? You see me give everything I got, right? But we talking about practice now. But it's an issue your coaches continue to raise. Look, I hear you. It's funny to me too. It's strange to me too. But we talking about practice, man. We ain't even talking about the game, the actual game, when it matters. We talking about practice. Why do you love Larry Brown? Him as a man, I love Larry Brown. The coach, that's something totally different. But him, the man, that's what I care about. That's my man, but with this shit here, we are not as tight as I thought we were. I do not talk to y'all about Larry Brown. The shit that hurt me was when y'all asked him about me, there should have been no comment. If you're going to get rid of Allen Iverson, then get rid of Allen Iverson. Do not assassinate his character. Just get rid of him. Simple as that. If Allen Iverson leaves Philadelphia, it is to make the team better. Why should I have a problem with that? The fans shouldn't have a problem with it. Why? Because you're doing it to make the team better. That's why you're making the move. But to assassinate his character, to say we're trading him because he does not show up to practice, he's late? Is it possible that Coach Brown is trying to motivate you? People talk about what's going to make me a better ball player. But once you figure out people are human just like you, then that'll help y'all out. I am trying to get better. You need to also. I am no different. I cry like y'all. I bleed like y'all. I'm just like y'all. But I'm Allen Iverson, and I'm sitting back here, and you all sitting back there. That's the only difference. Some people are saying that your name keeps coming up in the trade rumors because you're the only valuable commodity the team has. Why would you get rid of the valued commodity? You call me the MVP. The world called me the MVP. Why are you talking about getting rid of the MVP? All y'all that's real, that have a heart, know what this is about. You just have to ask the right questions. That's your job. So what's the tyranny here? So this manifestation, this paternalism, is a cultural phenomenon. It goes way back to the way we've blended our religious stories with existing power structures, and like monarchies and empires, with Enlightenment thinking, the rational means to an end. The way we see AI, not as man, but among other things, as a commodity that scores points. Being a Zen student is unique, but it's also not so different from anyone who is trying to get to the heart of things, trying to be real like AI. Students out in the world will come across the command and control mentality quite a bit and see it more keenly when they do. But being a student is not about delegating authority. It's being wholehearted enough to trust somebody to help you, even if you're hostile. Even if you're hostile, that shows that you're engaged, which respects the person. It respects the person you're speaking to a lot more than some dulcet-toned platitude. It's been hard for me to learn that, but I think it's worth sharing to others. Zen is different, and it's antidotal, even, in its lack of paternalism. It might appear like that superficially, but if we look more closely at the way masters and students relate to one another, it's a different kind of relationship. Zen presents an alternative to this model of repression. Les has refused to be that way even when I asked him to. And I really deeply appreciate that. It's freed me up as a person. He demonstrates every day, year after year, what the future of leadership can be. So what would a fully engaged Buddhist political voice in America look and sound like? What can we do? Take AI's example. Shoot from the heart. Be vulnerable, even if it's uncomfortable. Remember how many people this kind of repression occurs to quietly, all the time. Challenge others to grow. Realize their own potential, even when it's limited by the kind of self-limiting narratives or habits that everybody has. Be present. Face people directly. And when people face you up, listen completely. And above all, don't be bamboozled into thinking that life is serious. Life can be playful. Let's close with something from the epilogue again. I feel Americans, especially young Americans, have a great opportunity to find out the true way of life for human beings. You are quite free from material things, and you begin Zen practice with a very pure mind, a beginner's mind. You can understand Buddha's teaching exactly as he meant it, but we must not be attached to America or Buddhism or even to our own practice. We must have beginner's mind, free from possessing anything, a mind that knows everything is in flowing change. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Cannondoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to cannondoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O-E.org. nnondo.org.